Welcome to the Wagon Wheel Podcast, the show where we answer your questions on cricket, or I do, some of them, depending on what you ask. I'm Jared Kimber, anyway. Welcome to Combox as well. Normal show, as we do. If you are in the YouTube, I know it's a weird time, but my life is weird times at the moment, thanks to the ashes. If you're in YouTube and you want to ask a super chat, please do. But the best way, of course, is to go to the Good Areas Podcast and support us on Patreon. And then you can ask questions like Prudvi has, who says, what is the most difficult aspect of batting to learn? Certainly things can be gained with experience, but what is mandatory to be a great batter from a young age? Essentially, the most important thing is the ability to be able to saccage your eyes, which, you know, we talk about a lot in the book, Art of Batting, available now. But that's the most important thing, really, is that ability to not be able to track the ball, but be able to predict the path of the ball and make a good prediction consistently. We don't know how to teach that. We don't know how people learn it and how people don't. We don't know how there can be two people in the same family who both are technically good batters and one can do it and one can't. And one can't face over 75 miles an hour consistently and the other one can face 90 miles an hour. So I think that's the major part of it. I would love to track how we could teach people that. And if we could, I'd probably be a millionaire. But at the moment, I think it's a long way. I think it's a long way away from that. So that is definitely the hardest thing to learn. It's a really, really tricky thing. We're all taught to watch the ball until it hits the bat. And that's actually not what the great players do at all. MF Jim says, with the talk about the Big Bash getting privatized, how careful do you think the buyers would be to the franchises? Many Big Bash teams have their own fans, and it has done well to become part of the summer cricket culture over here. Also, Stars or Renegades? I was always Stars. Renegades is all more aimed at the sort of West side of things and, the Docklands. I never liked that as a football venue, so I didn't really get all that interested in it. It was certainly always a Stars guy, as much as, you know. Plus, I've worked for the Stars now as well. I don't think the people who buy it will be that worried about the fans, realistically. Most of these leagues are more about training and facilities, drafting players, seeing younger players when they're coming through the systems, making sure that your coaches and your structures and your social media always works. You've got something to talk about all year round. I don't think they're as worried about the fans in each individual place. If Mumbai, if the Ambanis were to buy it, you're going to have an MI team, right? Let's just be honest there. So you're going to change your name straight away. So yeah, there would be a lot of changes if that happened, which is one of the reasons they haven't done it. It was set up to be a private league, remember? And it's, weirdly enough, one of the last non-private leagues. James says, would you agree that fast bowlers who rely more heavily on trunk rotation through a longer delivery arm swing? I love every part of this. Thompson, Roberts, Tate would tend to swing the ball less than fast bowlers rely more on the run-up speed. Lilly, Marshall, Lee, Steyn. My theory is that the higher torque required by the first type of bowler makes it harder to maintain a wrist position. I think there's more. I don't want to call these guys javelin throwers because it's the wrong way of putting it. But if you look at Tomo and Tate specifically in what you've said there, and you can put Shoaib Akhtar in there a little bit as well. They are set up to bowl the ball very fast, but they're not always set up for their hand to come out completely straight. There's also, James, a lot of research that, of course, at the top end, once you get to that level of speed, you just don't swing the ball as much. I think Roberts is probably one of the first bowlers who kind of worked out that swing bowling isn't that important. So I don't know if there's an element of that. I think the faster you bowl, the harder it is to keep your wrist straight. Most trunk rotation, based on what you're saying, though, would be Waqar Yunus, and he actually did swing the ball quite a bit. So, look, ultimately, it is about your wrist being completely, straight and perfect as the ball is coming out, right? And I would say that if you're trying to bowl 90 miles an hour and as fast as possible, that is going to be much harder. Anyone who's ever bowled, I could never bowl much above medium pace. But if I wanted to swing the ball, I generally would slow down just a little bit. Have a look at Michael Nisa. It's a really good example of this that we're seeing at the moment. He's literally slowing down to get a bit more swing early on. Oh, Josh has come up with a lot here. Why were the Ashes dragged out so much, despite shortened matches? Within a condensed schedule, one could even fit in extra three T20s and three ODIs starting a day later. Would have made Cricket Australia a lot more revenue. So you've got, what's that, 10 days? Oh, sorry, that's what it was, 10 days break. I don't think teams really like playing the one-day series and the T20 series at the moment because it's different staff, different players, everything else. You know, it's completely different from that point of view. You've got, well, I'm just having a look at your system here. You've got a four-day break, an eight-day break, a four-day break, and a five-day break. I don't think that's enough for a five-test series. I think that's too much, Josh. We're already struggling to keep any bowlers on. So, yeah, it's very hard to keep getting the best players in the world to keep pumping out in the kind of system that you're talking about. Like, even if you look at your days, you've got 14th, 15th, and 17th. That would be, that's for T20 and 19th, 21st, and 23rd. Both of those schedules would really, really test teams. You know, even for any sport, for any T20 league. So I just don't think that's a realistic thing for your best players to go through. Abe says, you may have answered this elsewhere. You could start every question with that, Abe, but... which team do you think had the high ceiling in the last 25 years but really hit it? The highest ceiling but really hit it. You could almost make a claim for Australia, couldn't you, at a certain point? It's a generational bowling attack, and yet they've been roughly around the best team in the world, but they've not been very dominant, right? I'm trying to think of another team that I would put in that. I mean, South Africa are now starting to play the cricket we wanted, but South Africa with batting would have been pretty good over the last couple of years. I mean, Pakistan's probably the best bet because if you look at Pakistan on paper, they've got a leg-spinning all-rounder who can bat at six or seven. They've got two generational fast bowlers who have shown at the top level can be incredible. And they've got lots of nice bits and pieces with their batting, even if their batting isn't sensational. They've got lots of nice bits and pieces, you know, Safraz and Rizwan at the same time. Like, there's a lot going on with that team, and yet it has been pathetic, really, what they have managed to do over, you know, a period of time. I know they started to win at home a little bit, although they still lost to the West Indies, but it started to get a little bit better. But yeah, I would say they were probably the ones that, if you look on paper, they really should have been better for a period of time than they were. That's a very recent side as well. If you go back, I'm trying to think if there's any other sides. I suppose the Malinga Vaas Murali teams should have done better. Malinga doesn't play a lot of test cricket, but a peak Malinga with, you know, Vaas and his experience and Murali and guys like Fernando and other, you know, I don't know if Saranga Lakmal quite overlaps with that team, but they had other bowlers as well. And the batting is obviously, you know, Matthews, Mahela and Kumar all overlap. There's probably something within that team as well, would be the other one off the top of my head, the Sri Lankans. Hurt says, congrats on your expansion from good areas. On the pitch to zoom out and have a larger view of the sports landscape from Combox. Please explain how you arrived at this branding. Our inner ring has some wild theories. It's really, really hard. One of the things I looked at was, and I figured that this would be the case, that Bill Simmons would have talked about the ringer. And so I looked at the ringer and to see kind of how they came about it. And the creative side of it is not the hard bit. We came up with some really, really good names. Some names I still like even more than Combox. You know, I don't want to talk for Deepak and Robbie. I think they love Combox. Robbie's like, you came up with the name. And I was like, yeah, but, you know, I still like some of the other ones that I didn't come up with and some that I did. So we wanted something that kind of just felt good to us. But a lot of it is about social media, trademarks, websites, and all. It really is a complex thing. So you know, I love Robbie, but Robbie's like so enthusiastic and we'll come up with a good name. He's like, great, let's buy everyone. And I was like, whoa, we need to check all the social media. We need to understand how we're going to position this and everything else. So it's quite full on. I suppose a lot of it is that we kind of felt that what we were creating is an extension of the commentary box. So I think, you know, and Combox is a shortening of that. We are making commentary on issues rather than on ball by ball. It felt like something that was very cricket, but also that isn't just cricket. you know, which allows us, if we ever want to expand into other sports or anything, you know, cricket's our obviously our goal at the moment, and that's we want to nail cricket before we worry about anything else. But, you know, something like that as well. I like the names that I didn't want anything with cricket in the name anyway, just because there's too many bad cricket websites and apps and everything else out there. I didn't want anything with the word crick in it. I think that's done to death. I wonder if Crick Buzz now would be looking back and be like, maybe we should have come up with something better that didn't sound almost exactly like our main competitor. And so, yeah, you know, I remember talking to Simon. Oh my God, I've forgotten his last name. Simon, who set up Crick Info. Simon King, who set up Crick Info years ago. And like, they didn't think anything about their name. And yet they've ended up basically dominating the way that all names of all cricket websites and apps have been ever since. And so, yeah, so we wanted something that felt like us, that made sense for the company that we were coming up with, that we liked the sound of. You know, I think there was a few different things there. And I wanted it to be something that sounded good even if you didn't exactly know what it was. I didn't want one of those. I'm not a big fan of the made-up words, right? That, you know, that whole sort of genre of those sort of startup companies that just have these made-up words. I wanted it to be a word that meant something and that we understood what it stood for. And, you know, when it comes down to it, when you watch cricket, what is the first thing that you hear on the game? It is the people in the comm box, right? So from that perspective, it really made sense for us to go with that name. And I think it really fits the ethos of what we're trying to do, while also sounding good, looking good, not being long. I mean, there's so many things out there. We didn't want a that in front of it. Like, you know, all these different things is really, really tough. And Combox kind of did everything that we wanted. Ajit said, where do we get the names for fielding positions? Can we find a specific explanation for each one? For example, you have fine leg one side and third man on the other and not fine off on the other side. We don't really know this, Ajit. It is one of those things that kind of probably comes out of the 1700s when there isn't a lot of not a lot of cricket writing at all. You've got to understand that cricket was an absolute wild west in the 1700s in that there wasn't even one unified law. You know, all these different laws, everyone was playing different versions of cricket with different amounts of players over different amounts of days. And so fielding positions and a few of the shots also come out of that era. So we don't know is probably the best answer. We know that, you know, I think the Dulwich College story about a cow corner, which doesn't make any sense because you play from both ends, by the way. Like, it just doesn't make any sense. But that's one of the few that we know, and that seems to have come a little bit later, that sort of that cow corner. So that's probably 1850s to 1860s. So that means that a lot of those fielding positions, and that one's not even like an official fielding position, really, is it? So that means a lot of those other fielding positions were probably done like 100 years earlier, right? And my guess is, which is still the case now, but certainly more back in those days, that there were probably multiple names for all those positions. And eventually, each individual one came about. Like, if you know, the ball that rolls along the ground, right? The one that keeps low is called what? A goes under, a grubber, a shooter. It's got all these different names. I would have assumed the fielding positions would have had that as well. And then slowly but surely, probably as the tea towels started getting made with all of them on, or, you know, whatever that may be. But slowly but surely, I think there was more of a unification. And then probably the BBC and their radio commentary is where I would assume we get a sort of unofficial official list of what fielding positions are. So it probably doesn't become cricket law until the 1930s, maybe 1920s, when cricket writing becomes a bit more unified, you know, through England specifically, and then the radio comes on, is my guess. But even having said that, I think by that stage, most of the positions were probably pretty solidly done. But you're right, there's no real, like mid-wicket could be on offside or leg side, for instance. Like, it doesn't really make sense. Can I just say my favorite thing about fielding positions has always been that there's a position called straight, right, for the straight hit. And I've always thought, just for fun, it should be called straight on. And, like, other cricket historians don't like that, but I think it sounds cool. even though it makes no sense, but most of them don't make any sense. Ben says, the word lazy was used a few times to describe Archer in his last game of the series. I don't remember Broad or Anderson ever being called lazy when they weren't up to full speed immediately. Broad is constantly talking about napping while England batted, but Jofra having a pillow is an issue. Are these examples of some conscious racism bias that people can simply not understand his speed being sporadic? Yeah, I think there's a big argument for that, Ben. I'd also go further too of saying when Archer doesn't bowl at 90 miles an hour, we called him lazy. When Broad couldn't bowl at 90 miles an hour, we talked about him not being able to get his knees up. It's the same thing. Both of them were trying to bowl as fast as possible and move the ball around most of the time, and they couldn't find their rhythm. Broad's speeds are, you know, vary greatly, and Jofra's speeds vary greatly. We've come to a sort of, you know, someone like Mitchell Starc is a marvel at his ability to consistently bowl pretty much the same pace all the time. Not just the speed that he bowls. There are bowlers who can bowl faster than Mitchell Starc, right? It's very rare to bowl 140 to 148 as he does so consistently. And, you know, we don't have any allowances for that. And I think in Jofra's case, I think you're right. I think the necklace, the pillow, all there's a lot of coded stuff there that probably a lot of people need to think about a little bit more. But when it comes down to it, a lot of this comes from the fact we don't know that much about fast bowling. We don't understand why he can't bowl. So it must be that, we don't understand why he can't bowl as fast as we want him to every time. So our default as not understanding biomechanics and rhythm and all these things is he must not be trying hard enough, right? And that's obviously not the case. And I think we have more than enough proof now of Jofra Archer that not being the case. I just think that for someone like Mark Wood or Mitchell Starc, I think they're just consistently fast bowlers. And I think for people like Stuart Broad, Jofra Archer, I'm trying to think of some others. Josh Hazlewood's another one who can, you know, he can be mid-130s and he can obviously bowl over 90 miles when everything is sort of actually how he wants. Anrit Nokia, someone who is probably not far behind Wood as like, you know, a genuinely scary fast bowler. And how often do we see him bowl at 138? Like it happens quite a bit, right? When he's not fully fit, he really does struggle. So yeah, I do think that is an issue. I have travelled the cricketing world, and so I've collected two things, the phone numbers of random taxi drivers and overseas SIM cards. Rideshare apps have fixed the first part, and Sally is doing the second. Now, all you need is their eSIM on whatever plan works for you. You activate it, and you can use it anywhere in the cricketing world. It helps you save money. It is a global solution to a global problem. Stop fiddling with tiny sims and get the one that does it all. Go to Sally.com Good Areas and use the code Good Areas to get an exclusive 15% off your first purchase. Fly free with Sally.
Leo says, does the current England team management actually pay too little attention to the county cricket form performance when picking test players? If so, do you think that ignorance is justified? It's a really, really good question, Leo. Someone's actually asked me to write an article about this at the moment. But the best way of explaining this, Leo, is that in the history of cricket, first-class performance has been the best way of understanding if someone will succeed at Test cricket. But it's still an incredibly flawed method. It really tells you if you're going to be successful, to a certain extent, at home, right? And then, you know, that's probably why teams like Australia and the West Indies had a lot more success, is that they had more varied conditions at home, and they had, they had pitches that spun, they had pitches that seamed, they had pitches that bounced, right? I mean, West Indies and Australia are very different, but I always thought that was a big advantage to the West Indies, is that you could be playing in Sabina Park or you could be playing in Trinidad or Guyana, completely different. Right. So there was always an element of the first class numbers probably stacked up a little bit more, whereas the vast majority of English wickets are fairly similar. Right. That's not always the case anymore. Things have changed and everything. But traditionally, I always thought that was a big part of it. So I think for a long period of time, first class cricket was the best system that we had. We now have other things that we can look at and we should be looking at, you know, why is this person taking wickets in first class cricket? And does that translate to what we want them to be able to do? Where is this person doing it? So you get a lot of guys in English first-class cricket who absolutely dominate taking the new ball. Are they going to be taking the new ball for England? And I know this sounds weird. Teams have not traditionally always thought about this. We haven't gone out and picked the best first-change bowlers. we generally pick three seamers who are all new ball bowlers, and then we complain when one of them can't do very well because he doesn't have the new ball, right? So I do think you have to look beyond first-class cricket. But there are some things, and with Zach Crawley and Jacob Bethell, I think these are very good examples. It's harder with bowlers because we do often pick bowlers without a lot. But with Jacob Bethell and Zach Crawley, you're looking at people who have never shown they obviously have some elite batting skills within their overall athleticism and talent. But you're looking at people who've never been able to consistently make runs as a professional. And I think that is something that you should be looking at as a first-class structure, right? You know, and a lot of people will go back to the Michael Vaughan situation and the Marcus Trzaskowski one. Well, Michael Vaughan is a person who basically got picked, who probably took a little bit longer to develop. They knew about him. They understood what he could do against faster bowling. And he was picked at his peak. And almost the minute his peak finished, he was rubbish. He has like this incredible, 5 or 6 year period. And then it just all disappears, right? Well, that makes sense. That's not about, he would have absolutely smashed first class attacks in that period as well. Then you've got someone like Marcus Trzaskowski, who, again, they point to going, oh, well, he didn't have a very high average. No, but if you look at match factor, which we didn't have back then, but if you look at match factor and percentage of runs, he was incredible, right? So there were other things to look at there. So I think they kind of have convinced themselves that they can look beyond first-class numbers. There's still a lot of data to be gained from first-class numbers and understanding your players better. And I think you need the combination of both. It'd be silly not to take a huge data set like first-class cricket. Ali says, thoughts on Bangladesh frozen out of IPL and Indian tours like Pakistan too? I mean, I don't know what has happened there at the moment, Ali, to be fair. It's a really, really interesting situation. I tried to read about it like at 4 a.m. yesterday while doing the Ashes, and like I went through the articles, and I don't know if I've got my head fully around it. But yeah, it's a big development if that happens. I haven't been able to get my head around it well enough to give you something. But I think the World Cup, I don't think that's the most interesting thing at the moment, Ellie. I think the most interesting thing at the moment is how this affects the World Cup, which I do think is very fascinating. Mob says, happy holidays and congrats on Combox. Thank you very much. Why do players risk their entire careers to save one run on the boundary in a test match? I'm thinking of Blair Tickner's rotator cuff, for example. Players are diving all the time. They're diving into the crease. They're diving around the field. It's something that we expect of modern players. I don't think it's just a boundary thing. I think you see lots of injuries inside the ring as well. It's part of professional cricket. I think it's very hard to be a player who looks after their body. You wouldn't be seen as a team player. So, I think your team is more likely to win if you're doing that all the time. But your other point is also, you know, very valid. Ian says, happy new year. Hope you had a good one. Thank you very much, Ian. I've heard you talk about the MCG fondly and also Trent Bridge, but what are the grounds that you've visited and been most disappointed by? The Wacker. The Wacker. The Wacker. The Gabba probably as well. There's two Australian ones. Can't think of any in India. I mean, Gaul's an interesting one, right? Like the actual ground is not that impressive. And I don't think I really understood that until I'd been there before. I'm trying to think of any of the England ones. Headingley, I suppose, is another one. I think when I was a kid, I would mostly play video games at Headingley or Trent Bridge. If I wasn't using like an Australian ground, like that was, you know, the way I did it. And Trent Bridge just completely stood up in my mind, and Headingley just doesn't feel right. Has never felt that right to me. Trying to think if there's anything else overseas, West Indies. I think I like most of those grounds. I haven't been to all the New Zealand ones. Yeah, I think those, South Africa, South African grounds. Yeah, I think, again, I'm pretty happy with most of those off the top of my head. Hayden says, after the Ashes, Australia's next test assignment is against Bangladesh in August, Darwin and Mackay. Given their current position in the World Test Championship and their upcoming tour for India next year, should they consider making their surfaces spin-friendly, even if it means they lose a test match? No, they shouldn't be willing to lose a test match. I do think they should be using Darwin specifically as more of a spin hub. As you say, it's got a similar climate to South India. Remember, you can have a similar climate, but it's more about the pitches and they're still going to be a little bit different. But I think they should be thinking about, you know, Northern Queensland, although to be fair, it's probably the sort of Cairns area games, Cairns, Mackay, Townsville are probably a little bit more swingy green. But yeah, I think they should be thinking, especially in Darwin, of, I think any place in Australia where they have wickets that naturally spin, they should be trying to set up some kind of a hub there, even if it's not to play international games, but just for practice. And I would assume Cricket Australia have thought about this. It might just be a financial thing at the moment. But yeah, I would be looking at that. But I don't think you should go to a position, Hayden, where you are willing to lose the game. That's not how World Test Championships kind of go, right? Like, I you don't know what's going to happen in the future. So win every game you can. Alex says, should Hamid and Folks be in England's team next summer? I don't know about Folks. I don't know what England's going to do, right? Looks like they're going to, right as I do this podcast, you know, odds are they're going to be down 4-1. They still have a chance of 3-2 or 3-1, I suppose. But Hamid, for me, should be back in the side. They should be giving, I just think Hamid and Sibley are much better players now than when they dropped them. And I would want to test that at the international level. Manon says, thoughts on Vikram Solanke as a coach and a manager, seems astute and a thorough professional. Yeah, I don't know Vikram very well. We have friends in common through Surrey. I actually, when he got the Gujarat job, I sent him a message going, I don't know if you're looking for anyone, but, you know, happy to have a chat. And he was like, I think we've got everyone we need, but thanks. That's about all I've ever had. I can't think, maybe I've interviewed him when he was a player. I can't remember any. I know that he's seemed to be a very, very like professional person is the word I would use. You know, a lot of people like him a lot. I know he was held with very high regard at Surrey. It would have been interesting to see where he would have ended up in English cricket had he not gone to Gujarat. And he might still come back to English cricket. But yeah, oh, you've put professional in there as well, man. Yep, that's kind of how I saw it. Even in that response I said before, that, you know, I know a lot of people in cricket, quite often there'll be a job available and I'll message them and they won't get back, or they'll be like, why would we hire you? Blah, 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 we've got this or whatever. Like, sometimes you're just like, just be professional, guys. It's fine. Like, I'm shooting my shot. You don't have, I'm not going to name the person, but there was someone who I applied for a job and they had made sort of comments earlier that they might be interested in using me. And I applied for the job and they basically went, why would we use you? You know, and gave out a bunch of sort of random reasons that didn't even make a lot of sense. I think they were basically saying I would cost too much, which is fine. And I remember thinking, why would you be like that? Whereas Vikram probably didn't want me in whatever, but he was very professional and was like, you know, and that's how I've always heard of him. So yeah, not everyone is like that in cricket. So it does stand out. PJ says, I've had this question written down for a while, but I thought it would be a good time to post the takeover. When can we buy some good areas merch? I want a baggy with Patreon, with my Patreon joining number embroidered on the side. Maybe even a blazer to wear at fancy events. If there was a team good areas, would the color what would the color scheme be, and how would the badge look? Yeah, look, we talked about it. Obviously, we have the hats that we had made up, and we you know, we love our logo and everything else. It's the problem I've always had, and this is from the Cricket with Balls days, is how do you get the stuff at a good, cheap, good, you know, rate that is also available for people all around the world? You know, it's very, if I had the same audience base in like Europe, North America, right, Asia, I would probably make more money off merchandise than anything else. But it's so sporadic the way that we do it, and it's really hard to make it available for everyone. It's always been part of the plan. I think with Combox, it's probably been shelved. I should say the good areas side of it. But I can promise you that, you know, with Combox in the future, it is something that we've already discussed. And, you know, we'd be looking for partners and everything else. But it is tricky because India is such a kind of a black hole when it comes to like things work in India, but they don't work globally and vice versa. You know, things like Patreon, right? And so you're always in the situation where you have to take trade-offs. And, you know, maybe what we should be doing is making the stuff and just being like, okay, so one audience can't have it, and maybe even having two links. I think the guys I wore their t-shirts of, I can't remember, not Bodyline, but one of the other companies, they actually had a situation where they were had like two different stores. We just haven't really needed or wanted to do that yet. But we have t-shirt designs and stuff that we would like to try, and there's some other merchandise. As far as the colors go, I don't really know. We've never really settled down on like one color or how we want to do stuff. But yeah, I think if we had a badge, it would probably be involving the great man Iverson and his hand. Prudvi says, how do we differentiate between a failure of tactics versus failure to implement tactics? Because a lot of people just blame the tactics when they lose versus praise them when they win. And a lot of times when one's performance can make the whole tactics obsolete. So years ago, Prudvi, the first time I was ever on a bench for a team was with Hong Kong, where I wrote a behind the scenes article about what it was like to be in the dugout when that happened. And, you know, big thanks to all the people at Hong Kong Cricket who made that possible. And it was eye-opening for me. And the coach was, oh my God. So I forgot the name of the coach, but he's gone on to coaching county cricket, I'm pretty sure. A lovely guy and so annoying, I can't remember his name. But they had a plan for one Dutch player, Hong Kong, and it was try and hit the thigh pad. This guy liked to have his arms free, didn't really play particularly well off his pads. They thought they could pin him down, get him frustrated, then he'd play a big shot. And they're bowling across him, and he's slashing away and doing what he does, this dude. And so the coach then sends the 12th man to the boundary with a specific message to the bowler. Tell him, this is the plan, this is what we need. Next over, he's bowling outside off stump again. Coach turns to me and says, so, is he ignoring the plan? Can he not execute the plan, right? Or is there a third thing that we don't even know that is happening at the moment? Did the message not get through correctly? Is he misunderstanding it? Is there a communication thing? I was lucky enough to learn that lesson really early on, and I've certainly worked with analysis where I'm like, I don't understand why this is not happening, right? And sometimes it is they can't execute it correctly. Sometimes they think the plan's wrong. I know I had one team who I'd worked with, and I had to contact them going, I don't understand why you've done this. We specifically said, don't do this, and you did it. And this guy absolutely hammered you. And they were like, yeah, but your plan was bowling short and wide outside off stump to him. And we were just like, well, that's a bad ball. And I went, it is a bad ball to everyone except for him. I showed you the video. He can't hit that ball. He doesn't have a cut shot. He just misses it, and he tries to hit it to the leg side, and he spoons it up in the air. Instead, you bowled at his pads, and he flicked you over the leg side over and over again. Don't bowl in his wheelhouse. Bowl away from his wheelhouse. And so it is tough, and you never know. The truth is, you don't know. And sometimes someone can go against the plan and still be successful, right? So it's really tricky. I once made a pair in a club game, which is almost impossible to do. But I have been obsessed with batting my entire life. And so I put that into my new book, The Art of Batting. Being that I'm not very good at that skill, I decided to talk to other people who were. So I hit up as many contacts as I could just to talk about Rahul Dravid, Brian Lara, AB de Villiers, Kumar Sangakkara, Ross Taylor, Susie Bates, Nasser Hussain, Ian Chappell, and so many, many, many more. I wanted batters to talk about how they and their friends made runs, because that is the art of batting. James says, is England's fourth test win a sort of CPR for baseball, or does it say more about the volatility of low-scoring tests? Considering Australia's injuries and everything, like, it was probably due that they won one of these tests, right? Maybe the volatility thing does play a part, you're right. I still don't think they're that far off. I don't understand their bowling at all at this point. And I had more concerns over their bowling than anyone coming in, but I don't understand their bowling at all. But I still don't think they're that far off where they should be. It's just that they're, you know, the other team has been smarter and better. I'm more interested, James, and it's probably not going to happen now, but if they win the fifth test, 3-2, and they go, wow, we won two games in Australia. MF Jim says, do you think the pink ball will ever be developed to the point to take over the red? Players consistently delayed by bad light. This could be prevented with the pink ball. I think if cricket was run properly, MF Jim, we would already be there. The truth is cricket is not run properly. So we're in a situation where we just allow a crap ball to be used and we don't try and fix it. I would like to think that in the future we can come up with a pink ball, or it doesn't have to be pink, but a ball that works better in low light that still acts like the red ball. I think that should be the dream. Josh says, one of my ICU patients was an English fan who came out of a coma on Christmas Day. He watched the Boxing Day test and is now convinced Baz is the greatest English coach of all time. What should I tell him? this team is not a team that should have lost 5-0. Right? So you say, you You've seen the high moment, and some of this can still work, but they have to use it smartly, and they have not used it smartly, and that's why you've seen the only victory on this series so far. Abe says, which player's peak in international cricket do you think lasted the shortest relative to how good it was? Oh, I know. Would you go with someone like Jimmy Adams? Ajunta Mendes? What's Ajunta Mendes' bowling average? Test cricket. I know he played a little bit. He ends up taking 79 wickets at 34. What was that early in his career? The first year, he takes 26 wickets at 18. Yeah, it's gone by 2009. So it's not him. I mean, Jack Iverson, man, the guy on here might be another one. Bob Appleyard is probably another guy that I could come up with off the top of my head. Does Waqar Yunus fit into this? Freddie Flintoff, perhaps? Neil Harvey might be another one. So I think there's probably a few off the top of my head. You'd have to go back and check those, see if I'm right, Abe. Ajit says, I remember Hasaranga had one fantastic season with RCB, but then it didn't really work for him in the IPL. What might be the reason for this? He gets the same batters out in international cricket. I actually think, I could be wrong on this. Let me just look up his numbers. I don't think his numbers are as bad in the IPL as perhaps general consensus is about him. One of the issues is he's not made a single run. He's made 81 runs in 37 games, which is bizarre. He should be better at batting. I don't really understand why he doesn't make... He averages like 40 in first-class cricket. Like, I'm not saying some of that isn't... He should be better at batting. 40 in first-class cricket with 2,600 runs. I don't know. Anyway, in the bowling, he was incredible that first year. That was probably a year which was... He was too dominant. I think the next year... teams played him a little bit smarter. He's a bit of a one-trick pony, and it's a very good trick, which is he bowls a low arm action and he sort of skids the leg spinners through a little bit, which keeps stumps and LBW in play. And I think people started to play him a little bit more through the line, and he slides onto the bat at times. So I think that's played a part. But if you look at his second year in the IPL, he takes 9 wickets in 8 games and an average of 28. That's probably still fairly good without being brilliant. But he's going up to 9 runs and over, and he was 9 runs and over in the last season as well. But yeah, I just think teams have maybe understood him a little bit differently. As far as why it works in international cricket, I'd kind of need to go through his international numbers to see exactly why that is. I still think he's a good bowler, and I don't think the last 2 years he's been at his best in the IPL, though. He does feel like to me that someone who gets like niggly injuries a lot and maybe isn't quite always at his best. Hertz says, could you please compare and contrast the general approaches of Morgan Strauss setup compared with that of Stokes and McCullum, keeping format specific nuances aside. Morgan is a pragmatist who thinks very, very deeply about things. He's inspired by McCullum, and obviously they've worked together before, and they get on very well, but he's like the CFO or CTO to McCullum's founder. Right? Like as in the way that they go about things. He can sort of take the visions, but then he'll be very structured with the way he uses them. You've got Strauss here, but Strauss, like the Morgan Strauss thing is not the setup. It was Morgan Bayliss, right? So Bayliss was very good. He's a very good coach at sort of relaxing everyone and making them feel like they're in the right place, but not a very tactical coach. But then having a really tactical captain, I used to have this argument with George Dobell all the time, where George would be like, but Bayliss isn't tactical and whatever. And I was like, mate, this is the most formulaic side I've ever seen. They're literally playing to algorithms. Like I can show you the algorithms that they're playing to. But George couldn't get that because Bayliss wasn't that kind of guy. And that is true, right? So I do think there was an element there of, they had the sort of the more laid back approach of Bayliss, who was saying to these players, just play a natural game. Just do what you do. You can do this. But they also had a very structured, tactically aware, hardworking captain in Morgan. Stokes and McCullum are very similar. They're much more vibes-based. They're much more like a Bayliss type of thinker. They want everyone to be in the right. And maybe at times they have missed that sort of arch pragmatist type of person, that sort of Morgan MS Dhoni type of, and I don't mean the brain needs to be on that level, but having, I think one of the big issues with Stokes is it's been pretty much Stokes and McCullum's way, where if you look at Cummins and Smith, that I did a video on this, and Aaron Finch liked this video on Instagram. I mean, he may have hated the opinion, but I was basically saying that having Smith in a position of power within the Australian team actually makes a lot of sense, because Cummins does a lot of the hard work off the field, and he's very pragmatic, and he's very conservative, and he's very precise. But you also want a little bit of what Smith brings, which is, no. I know we had all these plans. It's not right for today. Let's try this. Or can I throw this at you? Or can we try this now? It's the combination of those two, I think, would make Australia a much better side, rather than just Cummins being in charge and never listening to Smith, or Smith being in charge and not working the way that Cummins did. And I think part of the problem with the Stokes-McCullum thing is, it's very much about vibes, right? It's very much about, like, we'll be right. We'll just keep changing it until it works. Whereas actually, if they had a little bit of that Morgan sort of structured thinking as well, I think that would be better. How did Morgan and McCullum go? Did they make a final with KKR as coach and captain? I can't remember. Ali says, if betting and surrogate companies were banned from sponsoring and supporting cricket, like cigarettes and alcohol, what would the effect be, what effect would it have on the T20 franchises and leagues? Look, you don't really have to ask this, Ali, because it just happened. You know, Dream 11 disappearing, and My 11 Circle, and some of the other ones as well. But Dream 11 disappearing as a sponsor has decimated leagues around the world. And lots of people have lost their jobs who have never worked in betting and have nothing to do with betting or fantasy at all. Lost their jobs because of what happened in India recently. So if you took that up to the next level, it would be huge. I don't know if you can do this, if that makes sense. The way that cricket is currently structured, I could be wrong, of course, but I'm not sure that you can at the moment, Ali, do this in a way that it was easier to do that with cigarettes. You say alcohol, but I think alcohol can still sponsor cricket, can't it? It certainly could up until recently, Ali. Yeah, I don't know what the final ruling on that is around the world, but I think there are places that could still use alcohol. Anyway, but the thing is that the surrogates is always going to exist, right? Like, it's very, very hard to get past the surrogates and the way that they do things. So yeah, I think you certainly have a situation there where it is very tough. But yeah, a lot of people would lose jobs. A lot of leagues would disappear. If you separate it, if you made it so that you couldn't sell your betting rights as well, a lot of those smaller leagues would just disappear straight away. Mob says, how much value is it worth for a slower bowler to never get injured, so Southee and Broad, versus a fast bowler who is out for, say, 50% of the games, Lockie and Jofra? Just wondering if there's a number that gets put on that and how pragmatic analyst conversations go. I mean, the way that it kind of goes now is more, we probably more look at it as a platoon, right, of fast bowlers, and that there are going to be some that are going to play every game and there are going to be others that don't. But yes, I think a bowler, it's not about the pace, right? It really is about the overall quality and how they can be used and everything else. So you talk about Broad. Broad could actually bowl at over 90 miles an hour, right? As we said before, he couldn't do it consistently like Jofra and Lockie, but he could certainly bowl over 90 miles an hour. Whereas with Southee, it would have been almost physically impossible. But that's not the way, as an analyst, I'm putting my bowling lineup together anyway, right? What I'm doing is making sure I have new ball bowlers, making sure I have some sort of variety, making sure I'm very good with my first change bowler. That's how I'm putting it together. I'm not going, oh, this guy's not going to play as many games. But any fast bowler, I think in the future, we have to be more realistic and be like, it's going to be very unlikely for bowlers to bowl over 90 miles an hour from here through to whenever cricket disappears, to be bowling consistently in games. Alex says, with Australia not picking a spinner 3 out of 5 matches, someone talked about that happening beforehand and was ridiculed. And Australian pitches being seamer friendly, is there a danger that they might go the way of England, where spinners marginalised and not prioritised in first class cricket? Spin's always struggled in Australia. There's absolutely no doubt about that. And if you look for most of the last 50 years, including during Warne's career, we haven't really produced a lot of spinners in first-class cricket. What has helped some spinners in Australia is the use of outgrounds, and some of those outgrounds are actually a little bit more spin-dependent at times. I think of, was it John Holland when he played for Australia? John Holland when he played for Victoria. I think there was a couple of grounds that still helped him. So I think that as long as Australia is thinking about that, and that's what I was talking about before of, where are the places where it just naturally spins, and can we do that so that if you play 10 first-class games a year in Shield cricket, can two or three of them be on wickets that spin? That's more than enough, right? Like, you know, that's way more than county cricket, right? When you go through those numbers. And then you still have the fact that Australian pitches can decay at the end, which again is going to help spin it. So yeah, I think you have to be very smart about how you, and this is not an Australian thing, this is worldwide. We've seen India make a mistake, we've seen England make a mistake, and we saw New Zealand get it right. But India basically did a similar thing to New Zealand, and it just went the wrong way for them, right? Like, I think what India tried to do was smart. Let's make sure we have more seamers available. Great, now no one can play spin anymore, right? When we make our wicket spin at home. So I do think there is an element of that, right? Having said all that, I think that's what you need to be doing. You need to be thinking about this. I don't know if India would ever do this, but if I was England, and I've said this for a long time, I don't know why all the county season is played in England if it is there to set up international cricketers. I would be playing a bunch of matches in the Caribbean, and I'd be playing a bunch of matches in Sri Lanka or UAE to make sure that everyone is used to it. It's still hard though, because at the lower levels, it'd be interesting to know what the pitches have done in club cricket in Australia. PJ says, seeing as though it's the first show of the new year, can you please give us a ball-by-ball breakdown of your pair in club cricket? Be as detailed as possible. Don't leave out anything. Set the scene for me. I was playing Craigie Byrne. Fuck Craigie Byrne. Fuck, I hate Craigie Byrne so much. The whole area of the town, or the suburb, or whatever the fuck they call it. Which really, really big ground from memory. We were going up against a team that was really good, and our team was just shot. So we'd come into the league where I think everyone thought we might be the favorite to win the whole thing. I think we won like six games in a row, and then our captain quit. It was really, really traumatic. It's probably the worst cricket season I've ever played in. And we had another leg spinner in the side, and that other leg spinner was really, really good. And I couldn't land the ball, and I couldn't spin it the way that I had been. The year before, I'd played under-16 cricket as an under-14 and had taken bunches of wickets in under-16s. And now I was playing under-16s, and I couldn't land the ball. I couldn't spin it. I now realize it was something to do with my I had a huge change in my height, and that changed everything. But I didn't know this at the time. I didn't understand biomechanics, right? So I was kind of like sitting there going, I can't bowl leg spin anymore. So I tried to turn myself back into just a specialist batter, which meant that I'd always batted with a freedom because I'd always taken wickets. And suddenly I was like batting, and I just got in my own head, and I couldn't make any runs. And this would have been about halfway through the season. And it was, we used to play day-night games in Australia in club cricket. And it was a day-night game over two Wednesdays. And the first one, and I had probably had an average of about 150 in day-night games coming into this. I loved them. I don't know what it was, but I absolutely loved them. And so coming into this game, I would have been batting at three or four because they were putting me up the order because I wasn't bowling anymore. And because I was trying to bat defensively so I could take some time. And I don't remember how I got out in the first innings, but I remember thinking to myself, I'm not going to make any runs here. Like, this is, I'm not seeing the ball well. I'm not moving well and everything. And we got bowled out for about 55, and they would have made about 200. And so because they're 2-day games, you can send the team back in. And so we got sent back in, and I think I got promoted to bat. I think I might've been batting four in the first innings. And I can't even remember if I was captaining, but I got promoted to bat at number three. And I was like, this is bullshit. Like, this is, I've never played cricket in this way before. Like, I was the guy who would bat like 2 meters out of his crease. Like, I was following Javed Mian down to Dean Jones. I would charge down the wicket. I was really attacking. Even when I was out of my depth as a batter, I found a way to upset bowlers and make runs. And suddenly for like half a season, my high score after 7, 8, 9 games, whatever it might've been, was like 20, right? I just was having a terrible, and the year before I would have made 650s, right? So like it had just, everything had just fallen apart, you know, and it's probably the time, without getting too much into detail, it's probably the time when my personal life was falling apart as well, right? And I was really having trouble at school and emotionally and everything else. So looking back, it makes sense that that was a bad year. So I was like, fuck it. I'm going to bat at number three. And I'm going to go out there and I'm going to bat out of my crease like I used to. And if the ball is there, I'm going to fucking hit it, right? And if I go out playing shots, at least I'll feel like I've gone out playing the way I wanted to. So I took my guard 2 meters down the wicket. And it was a medium pace bowler. Like, it was fine. I was going to be able to handle him. I think it might have been a left armer. I didn't have any issues with left armers. I was like, this is fine. And I got ready. But I was so in my own head that, like, and I was so ready to be attacking and to get involved and everything else that I didn't realize that the wicketkeeper had come up to the stumps. And I played against this wicketkeeper quite a bit in junior and senior cricket. And we had friends in common, in fact, as well. And he was a really smart cricketer and a really good wicketkeeper as well. And he just went, well, if he's got about 2 meters out of his crease to a medium pace, I'll just come up to the stumps. Then I didn't notice it. He was probably thinking I'd come back into the crease. And instead, I didn't notice it at all. And the bowler bowled a ball down the leg side, first ball, and I tried to smack it away and flick it over backward square leg for four, missed it. He took the bails off and I was stumped. And yeah, it was a very bad season. And then weirdly, we ended up, because we were so good, because we won so many games to begin the season, we ended up sneaking our way into the semifinals, which on talent, we definitely should have been the best team in the league, but we certainly shouldn't have really made it to the semifinals. And we made it, and we had to go and play Craigieburn, and they were the best team. And we played against them again. And this time, I was just like, I don't care what happens in this game. I'm just going to make it impossible to get me out. And so I came out to play, and they had this fast bowler called Killer, Kilpatrick. And he was just, I used to call him the Ox, because he was just fucking massive. This dude was huge, right? Like, for a 16-year-old, he was built like a man. He would have been about 6'4", 6'5", is my memory, but just solid and strong, and he looked strong like a man. And he hit the pitch really hard. Probably at that stage, I never played a junior bowler who hit the pitch as hard as he did. And we lost a bunch of wickets to him early on, and no one could play him. And I was just like, I'm just going to play him. And I think I said something to him that angered him at one stage. And he just went, I'm just going to hit you. And so I took about 8 overs on the body. He hit me on the shoulder, on the back, on the chest. And at one stage, I just stopped playing the shot. So I just started dropping my hands and flexing and letting the ball hit me, which made him angrier, of course. But George Foreman style thing of like, wait, what? You can't do that. And he's coming in harder and harder, bowling shorter and shorter, and just hit me. And I probably batted for about 30 overs in that game and made about 25. But we were like, I think we were about 70 odd after that 25, 30 over period. 5 or 6 wickets down, right? And I was the only one that day who managed to stay in. And then the medium pace, that same medium pace came back on again. And I was like, ah, this time, screw. And I just went 4-4 out. So I managed to stuff up twice in Craigieburn that year. But yeah, that was my pair. It's very hard to make it a pair in club cricket, but you can do it in Australian club cricket because we play over 2 weeks. Let's just see if there's anything in the super chats, and then we'll finish up here. Yeah, looks like we've got a couple. Walnut says, what do you think the future will hold for first-class cricket in associate countries? It's a fantastic question, and I don't know if I can answer that at the moment because I don't know if anyone's thinking about it. So I would assume that they're going to struggle. I wonder if we eventually don't end up with some sort of T20 as a franchise league. Sorry, Test cricket as a franchise league, as I've said many times before. Even if it's not quite a franchise league, but it's run better. And then we have second and third divisions. And with that, that money also trickles down to allow for first-class cricket in multiple different places to be played. But the other option is that it just disappears completely. And, you know, those countries are already struggling to play first-class cricket. A lot of them don't play first-class cricket. So it's definitely an issue and will be there for quite some time. Martin says, talking of young leg spinners having a growth spurt and not being able to land it or spin it anymore, the same thing happened to me. How should coaches help young leggies through that adjustment? It's a fascinating one, actually. I've never dealt with a young leg spinner since I've understood the dilemma. I think the most important thing is that it's very easy when you're short to get the ball up and down, right? And you're putting so much overspin over it in general. And once you get tall, what happens is if a ball goes up out of your hand, it's like you can't land it anymore. So I actually think that when that happens, the first thing you want to do with one of those kids is look at the biomechanics of it, right? So are they biomechanically sound? And were they biomechanically sound beforehand? Probably not. So can you, within a couple of weeks, just be like, okay, all we want you to do now is sort of line yourself up so that you're looking between your shoulder and this hand and then rotating your hips through the ball. And if you can get them back to that simple biomechanical thing, they can rebuild themselves. They have the, you know, I eventually worked it out, right? They still have the hands and the wrists, but I probably spent 2 or 3 years bowling leg cutters because that was the only thing I could land. I didn't realize that. It wasn't until a coach actually said to me, why are you bowling leg cutters, not leg spin? And I went, aren't I? So I was bowling leg cutters and wrong-ins, which is a really, really odd. So almost like Chris Harris with a wrong-in. And it was because the biomechanics had fallen apart once I'd had that growth spurt. And I had to change the way I was bowling. And the only way to get the leg spinner down was to push it, right? Which is basically a leg cutter. So I think if you see that happen to someone, you have to say, okay, let's get back to first principles. We need you to make sure that you are rotating through the ball, because once you start to do that, the extra rotations that you have, right, will dip the ball further and it won't go up out of your hand as much as it was before. And then it's them understanding that they can't bowl. They have to go, you always have to bowl up, but you want it to be more level coming out of the hand. Right. So you could probably do this if you wanted to, with like putting a chair down on the wicket and making sure that the ball goes under the chair and then spins up on the other side. Right. Or, you know, there must be some sort of a height thing that you could show that you can allow it, maybe putting a string or something in front of them, but letting them know that it doesn't have to go up like it did when you were 12. Right. And when you're 12 and it goes up, it's fine because it doesn't go through the roof. Whereas I was still bowling up when I was 15, 16 and I'm 6 foot tall. So it's like the ball was going so high. I didn't need to do that. All I needed to do was make sure I spun it up out of my hand, but then it just went just above the batter's eye line. So if you're biomechanically sound and you're getting the revolutions on the ball and you understand that that's what you now need to do, I think it's fine. But it's a tricky one. I don't want to pretend that like I've just answered it 100%. Where are we here? Umang says, it's already 6th of January in India, and I don't know if you do a live on the 7th, but just want to say happy birthday for everything you do. Hey, Umang, thank you very much. Oh my God, I'm so bad at this stuff. It is January 6th, you're right. Yeah, I probably would be doing a live on my birthday, depending on what happens. You don't bat, bowl, or field, but you still make cricket. The cricket world a far better place. I do bat ball on the field, but not very well. But thank you very much to you. And I don't know if anyone else caught up with him doing that as well. But yeah, thank you very much to that and everyone else. I'm off actually for the day. Thank you to Among Walnut and Martin and everyone on Patreon. Remember, if you want to ask questions beforehand, because we do these at random times, the best way is to go to Patreon and get a membership there. And that's Good Areas Podcast there. But please support us on Combox and everything we do. And we will be back I'm probably doing a live lunchtime show. I'll certainly be doing something at the end of the day. But thank you to everyone for your support. And we'll see you again very soon. Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bairam Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. Okay.
If you make a lot of content like me, oh, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.